Hi everyone, welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast. I'm your host and co-founder, Lonnie McGinley. Today we're joined by Dylan Kerr. How are you, Dylan?
I'm alright, pal. I'm very, very well. It's good to speak to you and see you. Finally.
Oh, good. Can you just tell the listeners a bit of a background about yourself?
Where do you want to start from?
Your playing career.
I started playing, I signed an apprentice professional form at 16 for Sheffield Wednesday. I got released by Sheffield Wednesday at 18 and went to South Africa to play for 3 years before coming back to England and signing for Leeds United. And from then I moved to Reading, to Kilmarnock in Scotland, to Hamilton Hackies, and then I retired in 2002 through injury, and I've been coaching ever since. My first stint was in American soccer camps, then I went and worked for the SFA as a football development coach in Argyll and Bute, which is one of the most amazing parts of Scotland I've ever worked and driven around and lived in. And then after 4 years of being with the SFA, I ventured back to South Africa, where I became an assistant coach in the South African Premier League. And then I went from there to Vietnam, where I became, I think it is the first British coach or manager to win a trophy in Southeast Asia. That's what I'm told. It might be true, might not be true, I don't know. And from there, I went to Burton Albion's Academy for 6 months. Left Burton and went to Tanzania to manage one of the biggest teams in East Africa, Simba. I stayed there for 6 months. It wasn't a very successful 6 months before I came back to England with Chesterfield's Academy. And up until then, 14 months ago, I moved to Kenya, where I'm coach of Gor Mahia currently.
Oh, brilliant. And as you said, you've kind of worked kind of across, you know, different parts of Africa. You know, can you tell us the kind of challenges of that, your kind of mindset of going into kind of sometimes it's the unknown? Because a lot of coaches go to America and Canada and they kind of know a little bit, but when it comes to like Africa and Asia, they kind of a wee bit unknown, and sometimes it can be a bit scary, but I think it's exciting too.
Yeah, I left home at 18 to continue my football career after being released by Sheffield Wednesday, and I'll be honest, it was my fault I got released. You know, I became more of a party social animal than, you know, thinking about my football, because I thought once I'd signed pro football contract, I was a professional footballer for life. But it didn't work like that. So when I went to, as an 18-year-old, you know, it was still in the middle of apartheid, and it was still whites one way, blacks the other. So I had to adapt fairly quickly, because we were actually a mainly predominantly white team. We had an Indian keeper and two black strikers, if I remember correctly. And I had to find out the culture in South Africa at the time. So when I got offered the job back in 2009, it was actually a player that I played with and I lived with when I was over there as a young player. He was an Irish guy called Sammy Troughton, and he's still there. He never left South Africa. He's managed quite a few clubs. And we lost contact for 20 years. And then due to Skype and Facebook and social media, you know, we got in touch with each other. And he invited me out to South Africa. So when I went back, I did 2 weeks as a coach for him. He liked what he saw, and he invited me back. But having lived there for 3 years and previously grown up as a young boy and learned the African way of life, and the strengths and the pitfalls, you know, it's something that I ended up going back knowing what I was going to, and I enjoyed it, and it was still the same. 20 years later, it was still the same as I was playing there as an 18-year-old. So going to Africa, it's daunting at any time, but, you know, having that experience as a young kid kind of helped.
Yeah, and just going back to your kind of playing career, you said it was, like, your fault, you know, because a lot now these days, you know, like, Mike Calvin's got a book on the state of play, and they kind of talk about the kind of youth. How do you think, some advice for the kind of younger players, or the 18, 19, so going to be potentially going into that kind of first team environment, what would you kind of say to them, you know, to try and, you know, not make the same mistake, because obviously you've kind of created a culture of we know, working hard. Some actually going to be a coach, but some of them will be able to play for maybe 10, 15 years before they kind of go into coaching.
Yeah, it's like when I was 17 years old and I signed my first pro contract, getting £60 a week from my £25 apprentice YTS scheme money, it was, my dreams had all come true. But at the time, Sheffield Wednesday had just got promoted from the old second division to the first division. And we became kind of, Sheffield's got a very, very good pop culture, some very good bands like ABC, Human League and Heaven 17, just to name a few. And in those days, as I still am now, I'm very, very passionate about music and I love my 80s music. And I actually got introduced to the Human League. We did a charity gig at the Sheffield City Hall to support the miners when all that trouble was happening. And I met the Human League, became very, very good friends with them. I attended and Heaven 17. And I attended more parties. I was clubbing more than I was worrying about the football. Thinking that, you know, I'd already signed my pro contract. I was a professional footballer for life. And I'd not made my debut. So I've got no regrets. You know, I did have, you know, at the time, because I thought I'd blown it. And writing to 91 football league clubs, as I did by hand, asking for trials, I only got 4 replies. And 3 of them weren't very good. One of them was at Birmingham City. And at the time, it was between myself and Julian Diggs, who they were going to sign. And they went for Julian, and then I got the offer to go to South Africa. And I always remember, I was sat with my mum and dad, and there were an African guy who was big, he was huge, he was like, oh, it was absolutely massive. And at the time, there was a big dispute between the South African Premier League going from NSL to NPL. Oh, sorry, NPL to NSL. They were going to change the league names, and this guy didn't want to do that, and he got attacked by about 3 fans, where they stabbed him on the field about 87 times, I think they stabbed him. But because he was such a big guy, he survived. And my mum and dad saying, "You're not going there. You're not going." And the good thing about it, I only had 3 days to decide, because they wanted me there for pre-season. So I just made that choice. But nowadays, you know, footballers have got to be very, very careful, because of social media, you know, and especially for a young footballer. And you can see the absurd amounts of money that they're getting paid. Even at young ages of 14, clubs are giving them a lot of money to sign, and they're giving parents, you know, signing on fees or buying them houses. You know, and if you want to make it in football, you'll be a millionaire if you sign a contract for 2 years. You know, in my day, you signed a contract because that's what you wanted to be, a footballer.
Yeah, definitely. That kind of mindset, you know, you've kind of got that growth mindset of, you know, you've kind of, sometimes you fail, but sometimes you succeed, you know. And I think failing sits a big part of succeeding, you know, these days. But you've obviously a lot of success, you've worked for a number of teams. What's your kind of highlight and the things you could possibly improve on, you know, as a coach but also as a person?
Well, you know, my highlight is proving everybody wrong. You know, I didn't do my career. If you look back at my career, every club I've been at, I've won something. I've either won a promotion, I've won a championship, or I've won a cup medal. You know, so you know that they're the highlights. Especially when a lot of people in my area, when I was a young boy, were saying I wasn't good enough to play with the best teams. You know, and I wasn't selected to be an apprentice until I was 16. And that was just pure luck, playing for my dad's Saturday pub team. You know, and it just, by coincidence, there were a Sheffield Wednesday, okay, it was a retired Sheffield Wednesday scout, but he still kept in contact with Jack Charlton, who was the manager at the time, and they offered me a trial, but then Jack resigned and went to the Irish squad, to the Republic, and Howard Wilkinson came in, and fortunately, Howard liked people who were fit, people who could run. And I could run back in the day. And that's, I'll be honest, you know, I had the footballing ability, but because I was able to run, and I mean, I could. Chris Morris, who used to be at Celtic, he was at the club. He was considered the best runner, and I used to leave him behind, you know, and that's what they loved about it. And I say, I worked hard for a year, and when it came to the end of my contract, this is what people have done to me, and this is what I keep. I've got like a, I'm not a rubber ball, but I've got like a springy mattress on my back, because every time I get pushed down, I bounce straight back up again. So when it was contract time after my apprenticeship, they told me I wasn't good enough to be a midfielder, you know, but they liked, because of my energy and because of my left foot, they thought I could make a very good left back. Yeah. So I worked for 6 weeks to prove that I could be a left back. And when it came, I knocked on his door and he said, look, it'll take a bit more time, but you know, your energy, your enthusiasm, your hard work, you've gone for it. He says, you know, that we're going to give you a contract for a year, and I signed my first pro contract. Right. And since then, you know, I've had success in South Africa, at Leeds, at Reading, at Kilmarnock, at Hamilton, Sheffield Wednesday, Blackpool when I was on loan, Doncaster when I went on loan. I've had all this success as a player, but again, I've always been at the knockbacks afterwards, you know, especially when I left Kilmarnock. You know, coming to, I won't say my end of my career, because I was only 32 when I retired, when I stopped playing. But, you know, ever since, you know, I was 14, I think I've had more knockbacks than, you know, positive, you know, outcomes. But I've always proved them wrong. And Howard Wilkinson's always telling me I'm like a rubber ball and just keep bouncing back.
Yeah, I think that's such a thing in society these days, you know, people say things or do things that are, okay, they're a wee bit, you know, harsh, but I think it makes you a better person, you know, to come back. You know, resilience is such a key aspect, you know. You've worked in kind of, you know, Africa and England and America, but can you tell us, like, your time at Burton Albion, you know, as academy coach? Because I'd like to know, because a lot of our listeners are kind of, you know, from Britain and America, but we'd like to see, you know, because Burton produces a really good academy. I'm just wondering the kind of the logistics and your kind of role and how you kind of influenced, you know, the kind of players you're working with.
Well, when I went to Burton, I'd just come back from Vietnam. I had a job interview at Stirling Albion. I came back all the way from Vietnam to have this job interview at Stirling Albion, and I walked out of the office and I thought, I've got this, I've nailed it. And then they give it to us, it's Sean McLaren or Sean McLean. Sean McLaren. And again, I was devastated, because I don't think I could have done the interview any better. And what transpired after that, obviously he sent them down and then he got fired. So I went down to Burnout. I got offered by an ex-playing colleague called Mike Whitlow, who was the academy manager, the chance to go and work with him with the under-18s, because he needed some help. And living in Mexborough, which is near Doncaster, travelling to Burton, I would have to leave at 6 in the morning to get there for 8:30 because of traffic, yeah. Going down the M1. And I would get home probably at 8 o'clock every night. So there was a lot of travel involved, there was a lot of time, there was a lot of work to be done, because the academy system now has changed since I was an academy player. You've got to do so much paperwork and tick all the right boxes for the funding of the club. But you know, I got to work with Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank more times, because he liked the way that we worked as a unit with the under-18s. And whilst we didn't have a lot of success, you know, with results, it wasn't about results, it was about development, player development. And I think that year, before I left, I think 1, 2, 3 got offered professional contracts. And I think two are still there and one's on loan. Two are still at Burton Albion and one's at loan. On loan, so, you know, your average back in the day was to get 2 players to the academy system. But now it's got less, because you know there's so much talent out there. But to get 3 and it was a fantastic achievement. I'm still in touch with those three as well. You know, and Michael Whitlow moved on. I got an offer to go to Tanzania. I got an offer to go to the Maldives and coach there, but it didn't tick my box for, you know, what I really wanted to do, because the island was small. There was only 8 teams. And even though it was the Maldives, you know, I turned it down. But then I got offered a job in Tanzania, where I went and I spent 6 good months there. But, you know, politics and corruption and, you know, officials, they didn't see my vision. They didn't see my philosophy. And we parted ways. And then I came back, and my old playing partner at Sheffield Wednesday, a guy called Mark Smith, who I've kept in contact, you know, since I left Sheffield Wednesday 18. He was looking for an under 18s PDP coach. I went there for just over 8 months, and again we got 4 players signed on professional contracts, and that was very, very hard, because Chesterfield were going through a bad time. Gary Caldwell was the coach at the time. He trusted our judgment. And unfortunately for Gary, he got the club relegated, and he left not long after. And I don't think he did get Chesterfield relegated. I take that back. He didn't. No, he didn't. The club was struggling. Gary left. But, you know, he trusted our judgment in the 4 players that we signed. And I think one's still in the first team now, two are in the first team squad, and one's on loan to a non-league club, which is experience, you know, because you know, you've got to be playing in this game. You can't just be sat in the stands like I did at 18. And yeah, so that academy, you know, you actually only do an hour's coaching, but you do 6 hours in the office, you know, on that PDP, you know, computer. You've got to do everything. It's got to be, every session's got to be noted, every report you've got to do every week, you've got to report on the players. And, you know, for me, football's gone out the window. They should be training for 6 hours, and we should be doing an hour and a half.
No, definitely.
Report.
You know, I can see the passion in the voice, and it's really amazing. And from that, you got obviously your head coach of Gor Mahia in Kenya. Hopefully, I pronounced that right. But
yeah, good, right.
But what's that been like? Can you tell us a wee bit, like, the philosophy behind that kind of the move, but also your kind of coaching? Because I know from the last couple of minutes, you're talking about your kind of youth. Do you believe in youth or youth experience, or, you know, like Alex Ferguson? You know, it was all about creating that youth, trusting them. Or do you have that kind of, is it different culture? You know, just tell us a bit about that if you can.
No, well, I got offered the job in 2014. Bobby Williamson was then head coach, and he went to the national team, the Roundy Stars. But I was contracted in Vietnam, and they wouldn't release me from my contract, and I couldn't speak to Gor Mahia, so they appointed another Scotsman called Frank Nuttall, who did very, very well in his time in Kenya at Gor Mahia. And then I met a goalkeeper coach from Kenya in Tanzania, and when this job came up, he called me, and it was all done and dusted within 3 days, and I flew out to Kenya. The team that we have, I mean, if you can imagine the size of Glasgow and Edinburgh put together and in between, so if you can imagine that size of area, which Nairobi is, there's only one field, there's only one AstroTurf field where you can actually train, a decent training session. Every other place, you know, the facilities are terrible, and I mean really bad. You know, they're either rock hard, full of stones, no grass. Some have cows grazing on them, some have donkeys on them, and that's not just my players. And you know, it's difficult because we are a big team. We've got probably the best players in the league, and you know, you always have to try and train the best players, but sometimes you've got so many players, so many teams wanting to play on this field that he's trying to get bookings, and if you don't, your whole sessions get wasted because you can't really train on the fields that we do unless it's on that AstroTurf park. But I think the average age of my players is 23. I've got a 32-year-old goalkeeper. I've got a 28-year-old midfielder. And the rest are in age between 26 and 18. And I've got a squad of 26 players. It's very, very difficult to sign players in Kenya because it's done outside of you. You know, the board members are the ones that identify the players and they sign them. And you just get what you get. You've just got to, you know, do as much research on them on YouTube or find as much information as you can on them and work with them to fit into your jigsaw. It's like I always call my squad, you know, it's an unfinished jigsaw. And the reason I say it's unfinished is because you're always trying to find that one player that can fit in. You know, and so, sometimes it doesn't work. You know, you'll sign a player and it just, no matter how hard you try to fit it in, it's just the wrong shape, it's the wrong size, it just doesn't happen. But I would say that 95% of my squad, the jigsaw's nearly complete. And right now we're in off-season, but we start on the 27th of November. I can't go back till the 20th because I've got a specialist appointment for my back. So we've got a very, very big game on the 27th. It's CAF qualification for the Champions League. And so I've got to trust my assistant manager. I've got to trust my coach, which I do. You know, funny enough, you don't get assistant managers that you trust because they're always after your job. They're nice to you face-to-face, but as soon as you turn your back, you're gone. They want to stab you in the back. But I've got a good coach called Zico, and I trust him. You know, he knows what I want. He knows the standards I work at. He knows the what's required of the players, and I'm quite happy that I can trust him and just hope that we get it right when the game comes. Because if not, then you know that's me under pressure straight away. You know.
Yeah. I was looking at your profile. You've got a pro license. You know, it's really decorated now. You know, with a lot. I've kind of, you know, through the SFA, I've kind of been watching, you know, the kind of clips they do, and it gets you inspired, you know, because I'm completing my e-licence at the moment.
Yeah.
But can you just tell us the kind of the steps you took to get there? Because I know it's slightly different now, but I'm just wondering if you could possibly just tell us how you kind of got there.
Oh, it's a lot different now. I've actually been up in Scotland 2 weeks ago to do my CPD. And I was actually fortunate that Greg Patterson, who's now kind of taken over the role of Jim Fleeting, invited me to do the A licence, and I spent 2 days doing theory and practical. The practical was hell, because from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock, we were just playing football, you know, and because of my back, you know, I find it very, very difficult to run now. But I joined in, and back in the day when I did mine in 2001, and I failed it, but I failed it because I wasn't ready. Yeah. I'd just come out of playing, and I didn't get used to the expectations of what the demands were as a coach. It kind of went past me, but I'm glad I did it, and I failed, which I'm glad I failed because it gave me that incentive to make sure that the next time I got it. And on the course, in the first one in 2001 was Ali McCoy's, Alan, oh, I can't remember his name now. There was when David Moyes was an assessor, Jim Sinclair was an assessor. There were some big names that were assessing, and there were some big former players there. And of course, there were this unknown Portuguese guy at the time that everybody actually, I actually thought he was a fisherman or a waiter. He introduced himself as Jose Mourinho, and we became very, very good friends on that course. He calls me Crazy Dylan, you know, and he respected what I did, and I respected what he did, because we had the same opinions at the time about the course. And I said, I don't know if he did pass or he failed. I don't know, but I failed it, and I failed it because I wasn't ready. And when I went back in 2005. The course assessor that I had was Jim Sinclair, who was very, very strict. You had to do everything on the dot. Everything used to have to be right. And I got it. I passed, and when I got my letter from Jim saying I passed, I was like over the moon. I mean, probably one of the best feelings ever, because not only done it, I'd done it with Jim as well, being my assessor, who was very, very tough. And I've always wanted to be a coach. I did my prelim in South Africa as an 18-year-old. But when I went back 2 weeks ago to Edinburgh, to the new Orium Centre where the headquarters are now, there were 66 coaches on the course, where back in the day there was like 20. And those courses that I did, you were just based on your football. You know, everything was just football related. You know, you've got no paperwork to do. You've got session plans to do, but nothing compared to what you have to do now. I mean, it's whether it's better, whether it's, you know, worse, only people that do the course can say. But, you know, it was 2 weeks, you were assessed, you were given a pass or a fail, that's it, done. Now I think the A licence takes 2 years to do.
Yeah, so it takes a year, but you're prepping for
a year
beforehand, though. Like, when I was doing I completed my B licence, and then I asked, you know, the tutors, I was taking the next level, and they said, well, not around the moment, you're not ready for the A. And I might not be ready for the A still. It's how you're doing the day, you know, but I emailed Greg, you know, about the kind of the course and all that. Can you send me information? And I'd done about a year and a half prep beforehand, and then, you know, we were on the same course in Edinburgh, that kind of thing. And I probably had one of the worst sessions in my life, you know what I mean? In the summer, you know, the first session, everyone's a wee bit nervous. Second session, came out with a shell. Third session, yeah, this is really good, this bit, maybe improve this bit. But it was, you feel, but the first thing, it's always self-reflection, you know, because you feel, see when you don't do well, the first thing you want to do in that, the next morning, is spend 20 hours, your day just going, you know, this is wrong, this is it. But the biggest thing I learned from one of my mentors, you know, Alistair McCoy, says, you need to just think about, okay, what did you do well? What did you not do well? Because everyone focuses on the negative, but what did you do well? Or you don't think about it because you think negatively. But I said, well, I got this bit, this right, this bit right, this bit wrong. I said, okay, well, just work in the bits you're doing really well and see the negative side of it. People make mistakes. That's how, as a coach, we learn.
Yeah, of course you do. You don't get any better if you don't learn. That's like I said, 2001. I'm 30 years old, and I'm thinking, right, I'm gonna take my A license. And like I said, I wasn't ready, you know. And you talk about self-reflection. It hurts when I'm not used to failure, you know. And again, you know, it's like I've got that spring on my back. You know, I failed it, but I'm not going to lie down and give up. I'm going to make sure that I get better. And the only reason I think it took me 3 years is because I went to America. Yeah. You know, I was promised, you know, I'd get a visa, I'd get a work permit. You know, I didn't get a visa, I didn't get a work permit. When I came back to Scotland in 2005, luckily, nobody really wanted the job in Argyll and Bute because of the travel, of the distance where... And again, I used to live in Troon and have to go to Dunoon every morning. You know, so again, up at 6 o'clock to get into the office for nine. You know, and days like where you're travelling to Campbelltown to do one session and having to drive back. I mean, it was amazing for me. And that year, I decided to resit my licence. And not only did I do that one, I did my youth licence as well. But I didn't finish my assessment because I was abroad. And I also did my goalkeeping license, but I didn't get my goalkeeper's license. I actually went on it, you know, to think, well, let me see what a goalkeeper course is like. It wasn't about getting the license, it was just about picking up insights and watching how the goalkeeping course works. Had I got it, if I'd have been a goalkeeper, I'd have probably got it, but you know, being a left back doesn't really help. But I enjoyed the course, and you're always learning. You look at people and you learn from what they've got, and you think, yeah, I can use that in my bit, or say, ah, that's not for me, and that's how you learn. It's like every game's a different game, so you learn from how good your players are day to day, how good the game is today. And if it was perfect, totally perfect, you wouldn't enjoy the game because you wouldn't be stressed, you wouldn't have them emotions of wanting to win all the time. And you know, the biggest thing I've always learnt about myself is that if I see something that's wrong, I need to fix it. Need to fix it. And sometimes things don't work for you because it's not your fault.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I've found that this year, more so in Kenya, there's been 8 occasions where outside influences, club decisions, players leaving, absconding, not training, travel, bonuses, salaries, you know, I'm not going to swear, but they screw you up, you know, and that's out of my control. You know, all I can do is try and make it better. You know, and sometimes you can't do that because it's nothing to do with you. You can only try and advise, you know, it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, definitely. And you talk about, you know, learning. You know, you speak 4 languages. Can you tell us what they are and how you can learn them?
Well, I can speak Kiswahili. I can speak Lua, which is our tribe, Gomaya tribe. I still speak Afrikaans. I can still speak Xhosa. I can speak Vietnamese, but that's losing now. And I'm a wee bit Scottish as well. I can speak a bit of Scottish. And I'm a Yorkshireman. So the reason you have to learn the football lingo is because, again, your assistants and your translators, as I found out in Vietnam, very, very quickly, because the local foreign players who were playing there who knew Vietnamese, the first thing they told me is that you've got to learn the Vietnamese football language, because they'll tell your translator one thing and he'll say totally the opposite, because he thinks he's a coach. And, you know, you've got to know what the good things that they're saying, positive things, but you also got to find out if the negatives, because, like, again, your assistant is supposed to be on your side. When you're talking to him, he's like, yes, boss, yes, coach, well done, boss, well done, coach. But then when you turn your back and he's shouting in Swahili something totally different and you don't know about that, then, you know, it comes back to you because, you know, they're going against what you're saying.
Yeah.
So you have to try and get up to speed very, very quickly with the football coaches. Just recently, we played Everton at Goodison Park, which was a fantastic achievement. You know, my philosophy to combat Everton was for the 2 strikers just to drop off and let the 2 central defenders have it.
Yeah.
But then I've got my assistant screaming, no, they want to press.
Yeah.
You know, so it's... And I get what he's trying to say, but, you know, at the end of the day, we've done a training session where we just let the 2 central defenders have the ball, stop their wide, their fullbacks getting on the ball, which is where their strength is at Everton Football Club.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, but you just speak to them and just say, listen, you know, this is how we're going to play, this is what we're doing. But like I said, he's a good guy, my assistant, real good guy.
Yeah. And we kind of finally wrap up with a question of, like, what does mindset mean to you? So can you just tell us a kind of sentence or a paragraph, like, kind of, what does mindset mean to you?
Mindset is just go out, win the game, enjoy the game, play with a smile, be energetic, be enthusiastic, don't beat yourself up if you make a mistake. Why did you make a mistake? Fix it, don't do it again. And basically have that passion, just have that. I always call it the second best job in the world.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to grasp it, because it only lasts for such a short term as a player, and not very many people go into the game. And I've experienced it when I retired at the age of 32. I think I were thinking that I'd get a job in football. 2 years, I didn't get a job in football. You know, so you've got to grasp every opportunity, and no matter if anybody else ever tells you that you're rubbish, just don't listen to them. Just don't listen to them. You know, just let go in one ear, let go out the other ear.
Brilliant. And where can people find you on social media, or your kind of club or anything like that, or is it just you?
Oh, my social media is on Facebook, just Dylan Kerr, and on Vinnie Jones has always called me Legend. I don't know why, but he always called me Legend, so my Twitter handle's @Legend3. And I'm on Instagram. It's Haiphong3, the team I used to coach in Vietnam.
Okay.
Don't know why I give that name, but I just put Haiphong3. The only thing that I put on social media is good things, positive things, family things, And yeah, I'm not on anything else.
Yeah,
no, that's it. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Thanks for your time, Dylan.
No, you're welcome, pal.
Thanks for listening. If you don't already, give us a follow on Twitter at The Curve Mindset, and please like and retweet the podcast. And also, if you can, leave us a review on SoundCloud or Anchor. Thanks for all your support.